On October 25th, 2019, the Santa Cruz chapter of the ACLU is presenting a forum on facial recognition technology. This will be at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which is located at 612 Ocean Street. The panelists for the Facial Recognition Forum will be Lee Heppner. He is an aide to San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin, who recently led a move to create a ban on facial recognition in that city, the use of that technology by police and others. Also, a participant will be Matt Cagle. He is with the Northern California ACLU, and he's an attorney in technology and civil liberties. Justin Cummings, Santa Cruz City Council member, will also be there, as well as Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of Media Alliance. So they're going to be talking about what facial recognition technology is, who's using it, and why it might be good to ban its use. And again, that forum is being put together by the Santa Cruz ACLU on October 25th at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And I'm very happy to have on the phone here today Matt Cagle, who, as I mentioned, is an attorney with the Northern California ACLU. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us first, before we get into the recent bans that have happened regarding facial recognition technology, tell us first what exactly that is and how it works.
Great. So facial recognition technology, it's been around for a number of years, but recent advances in the power of computing technology and the dropping costs of computing power have enabled computer systems now to cheaply and easily map out somebody's face, create a face print from that, and to compare that against databases that might contain thousands or millions of other faces. So facial recognition is a software system, but the facial recognition system can be applied to many different types of videos and footage already in existence. Many of our communities have surveillance video cameras. Many of our communities have officers with body-worn cameras. Those video inputs can be now combined with facial recognition to enable the government to identify you as you walk down the street, know where you're going and when you were spotted. And frankly, that raises a lot of concerns because it gives the government an unprecedented power to track our private lives and frankly to exert sort of control over our lives in a way that is unprecedented.
So the typical question that arises around surveillance and there being a lot of cameras around, and maybe you can describe how many cameras there are really around and who's using this kind of technology, but often the first question that arises is, hey, if I'm not doing anything wrong or illegal, why should I worry if I'm being constantly photographed or recorded in different ways? What do you think, how do you respond to that notion?
Well, it's not just about having something to hide. It's about having something to protect, right? And so for many of us, for all of us, we value the ability to walk down the street without being watched by law enforcement. We value the ability to attend a political protest without having our identity placed in a government database simply because we chose to exercise First Amendment rights. So it is partly about protecting the civil rights and civil liberties that we have long cherished and that the government previously had fewer tools at its disposal to infringe upon. But it's also about remembering that when facial recognition is deployed or when other surveillance technologies are deployed, their impacts are not felt equally across society. Disproportionately, it's people of color, it is immigrants, it is political activists who find themselves on the receiving end of discriminatory government surveillance, logging onto government watch lists. And when you are being watched more closely by the government, there are more opportunities for the government to intervene in somebody's life with an investigation that could really ruin their life and disrupt their life, to accuse somebody of a crime that would require them to defend themselves, and to identify infractions that before the advent of this sort of technology would not have risen to the level of the to law enforcement. So it allows the disproportionate enforcement of laws in a way that can be very discriminatory, and it allows arguably the over-enforcement of laws against particular populations who have historically been subject to surveillance more than most of the population.
I think people often do forget that the U.S. government and police and military have used surveillance and disruptive techniques throughout the history of the country to stop activism. Even Martin Luther King Jr. and his father and his father's father were all surveilled by the U.S. government. These people were pastors who were calling for nonviolent civil rights in this country. Likewise, during the Vietnam War, one of the heaviest, most surveilled groups were the Quakers, and much earlier than that, people that were calling for the abolition of slavery were surveilled, and their activism was disrupted. I agree that that is really part of the root of the problem here. Maintaining a democratic culture with heavy surveillance. I don't know if you have more to say about that realm.
Yeah. So we're already seeing. As you said, you're completely right that the history of surveillance in the United States and even here in California is a history of surveillance powers being turned against those people who have been identified as a threat or as a target of law enforcement, be they immigrants or black activists or anti-war protesters. In 1973, I recently saw an article from, I believe it was the SF Examiner, explaining how in 1973 the San Francisco police had amassed intelligence files on 100,000 people, including civil rights demonstrators, union members, and anti-war activists. Those records took decades to amass. Right now, today, with a facial recognition system that is automatically, without any human effort, scanning the faces and logging the identities and locations of people in a community, the city police in one of our neighborhoods could log information about 100,000 people in so much less time, in just a few hours. So that gives you a sense. I think that gives you a sense of like the scale at which modern surveillance technology enables governments to exercise their powers and to abuse their powers. And facial recognition really does pour fuel on these fires we already have in our world that are about discriminatory policing, the over-enforcement of laws against some communities and some neighborhoods and not others. We need not conjure up a sort of science fiction future where this sort of thing is happening. If we just look to the news stories being written about China, who admittedly has a different government system, but who is using facial recognition to track, profile, and control a minority population known as the Uyghurs, who are a largely Muslim population. And there are scenes in these articles being written by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal where entire city squares are now more vacant because people who know they're going to be watched and tracked when they go into a city square or go to a square in front of a mosque even, they avoid doing that. And so it chills the exercise of the freedoms we all take for granted. And so we don't need to conjure up a science fiction fantasy to understand what the reality is when you deploy these systems that allow for pervasive automated tracking of our communities.
I'm speaking with Matt Cagle. He is a civil rights and technology attorney with the ACLU of Northern California. He will be one of the panelists here in Santa Cruz at a forum on facial recognition technology and what to do about it. That is being organized by the local chapter of the ACLU. That's happening on October 25th at 7:00 in the evening at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Matt, I'd love to hear more about what you have discovered about facial recognition technology in terms of what you mentioned earlier, the racial bias that it seems to have, the technology itself. Of course, it was created by human beings who themselves have their own racial bias. Tell me about that. I know also from looking at predictive policing, which is a particular computer algorithmic system that was really evolved here in Santa Cruz at the police department here, that there is sort of an inherent bias in that as well, according to journalists who looked at that. Tell us about the racial bias. I think in one of your writings, you mentioned that some folks who are part of the government were misidentified as criminals using facial recognition. Tell me about all of this.
Right. So, you know, as you said, surveillance technologies are made by humans, and they're made by humans who have our own biases and based on and built on data that may be reflective of a biased society. And so facial recognition, for the past few years, researchers have revealed that prominent facial recognition products suffer from serious inaccuracy and bias issues when it comes to recognizing faces of color, and particularly women of color. Some of these prominent products are off by significant orders of magnitude when they scan and seek to identify a white face versus a black face. That is in part, as I understand it, because of the nature of how facial recognition algorithms or formulas are developed. They are developed by telling a learning algorithm to look at a wide array of photos, sometimes millions of photos of faces. All too often, those data sets of faces don't adequately represent the real America and, frankly, the real world, which is that it's not just white people. It's people of color, and it's people of all shades of brown and black and white. And so what has happened is that these systems have learned how to recognize faces, but they've learned how to recognize white faces more than they've learned to recognize black faces. It's not only that, though. I've heard from more researchers and experts in this area that the way that modern photography has been designed is more apt to creating detail and displaying white faces than black faces. So there's also sort of a history of bias in the way photography developed. What this means, though, if facial recognition identifies you, even one false match in the field, that means law enforcement officers may be making life and death decisions off of inaccurate information about who you are. So facial recognition, as we discussed earlier, it raises serious concerns when it can perfectly track you in a community. But it also raises significant concerns when it is imperfect because of the risk it invites for misidentification, the mistaken approach and use of force by law enforcement, mistaken arrests, and all the consequences that flow from that. And then just very quickly, we recently ran, we created our own facial recognition test, and we ran Amazon's product that they offer to governments against all the members of the California legislature. And that system misidentified 26 legislators as being in a database of arrestees, people with mugshots. And that really made a huge splash in Sacramento because lawmakers realized what experts have known for a long time. This technology is flawed, and that it can really harm people if they are misidentified in the real world.
It shouldn't be, but it is continually surprising to me to discover who and what companies are involved in this kind of technology, surveillance technology or military technology or arms production. And you're mentioning that Amazon is one of the companies that provides facial recognition technology to the police. Their system is called Recognition with a K. IBM and Microsoft also make these kinds of systems. Tell me, I don't know what you think about these companies that we know as maybe entertainment companies or companies that help deliver goods to our homes. They're also providing surveillance equipment to police departments across the country.
Yeah, so in early 2018, I was on Amazon's website and browsing the section of their website that is called Web Services, which is a large part of Amazon's business. They provide servers and web hosting services and computing services to many businesses, and it is a big part of their revenue stream. On their website, I noticed that they were talking about this product called Recognition, like you said, with a K. And on, they had a customer page on that website where they were touting law enforcement agencies using Amazon's facial recognition product. And that was really stunning. We didn't think that the world knew about that. So we coordinated with ACLU partners in Oregon and Florida, and we sent public records requests to the neighborhoods and the agencies where Amazon said this was being used. And what we learned is that, yes, it was being used against, you know, hundreds of thousands of photos, and that Amazon was not only providing the service, but it was also providing feedback, technical support, and advice, all without any meaningful guidelines or restrictions on how this technology could be deployed against the public. So in Oregon, there's a sheriff's department that is using this to essentially do digital lineups and to identify people without using hardly any, you know, restrictions that are designed to protect people. So when Amazon, a company like Amazon, who has traditionally delivered books and packages, moves into another area like facial recognition, that could be a real game changer because they can drop the price like they often do with products and really make it something that law enforcement can easily deploy against communities. And we think it's really, really irresponsible for a company like Amazon or a company like Microsoft to offer facial recognition to governments and then sort of wash their hands of the real impacts this technology has when it's deployed. And so we've done a lot of advocacy to raise awareness around Amazon and Microsoft's sale of this technology. We brought together a coalition of over 85 civil rights organizations earlier this year and demanded that Amazon and Microsoft take their products off the table for governments. And, you know, we're still waiting a meaningful response, but we do think that the public opinion has really turned against this technology, and we're really excited to see what legislators are now doing to protect communities.
I would love to hear about that, what legislators are doing about these technologies. I know that in San Francisco, the governor has signed into law something about facial recognition software on body cams, that won't be allowed on body cams beginning in 2020. And also, Supervisor Aaron Peskin in San Francisco has created a ban on using facial recognition technology there. Tell me if that's accurate, both of those.
Yeah, so this May, Supervisor Peskin, one of the 11 supervisors in San Francisco, working with our coalition of over 25 civil rights groups, we passed a ban on the government's use of facial recognition in San Francisco. This was the first ban of its kind passed at in any city in the United States and maybe even the world. And it really has had ripple effects on the conversation around what we do as a society, when a new technology comes onto the scene that presents an unprecedented threat to civil rights and civil liberties, and how do we use the democratic system to protect people before these systems are built and deployed? So San Francisco passed that ordinance in May, and since then we've seen proposals or ordinances actually passed in Berkeley, in Oakland, and in two cities in Massachusetts, Somerville, Cambridge, and Brookline have all proposed or adopted bans as well. And so you're starting to see a real sea change in how legislatures take responsibility for protecting their residents from new technologies and really focus, and which really allows legislatures and policymakers to focus on real public safety solutions that don't have the same impacts on civil rights and civil liberties. Just last week, at the state level in California, Governor Newsom signed AB 1215, which says that California law enforcement may not use facial recognition or other biometric surveillance, so tracking your voice or your irises or the way you walk, they may not use that technology in conjunction with body cameras, which were, of course, promised as a way to keep officers accountable, not promised as a way to track all of us. And so that's a really great progress at both the local level, and the state legislature is also starting to respond. So we're excited to see really where that goes next.
I was curious, you know, when police departments started using body cams, you know, obviously it's cheaper and the police can control the camera themselves if it's on them. But if the public is trying to have accountability of what the police are doing, it would make more sense if the cameras were pointed at them instead of at us. And here in Santa Cruz, the Santa Cruz Police Department has fairly recently, the last few years, started using body cams. My understanding is no one really has access to that video, though, not even the police auditor, who now doesn't even exist in Santa Cruz, and there is no oversight committee. Do you happen to know if facial recognition technology is used at all in Santa Cruz Police Department, or if there is a plan to add that in Santa Cruz?
I'm not aware of current use by the Santa Cruz Police Department. We've recently done some public records requests here at the ACLU to learn more. And my guess is that, you know, the vice mayor and other policymakers are going to have a better sense of whether that's happening. But, you know, we don't and we shouldn't wait until these technologies are deployed in our communities to really think about what are the right steps to take to rein them in and to protect people's civil rights. One thing about facial recognition systems that is true for other surveillance as well is once we build these systems, once we allow governments and law enforcement to build these systems, they calcify and they expand. They're very difficult to rein in once they've been built, and that's especially true of facial recognition, which can be quickly deployed as a software. You don't need to build new towers or buildings to deploy this or buy very expensive technologies. It can be deployed very quickly and expanded very quickly. And so we think it's important to have a conversation before the technology is even deployed about what are the proper limits that should be in place for any surveillance, and for facial recognition, whether it should just be taken off the table and you know, move forward from there.
My name is John Malkin. This is Transformation Highway, and you're listening to KZSC 88.1 FM, broadcasting from the University of California in Santa Cruz, also online at kzsc.org. Today, I am happy to be speaking with Matt Cagle. He is an attorney with the Northern California ACLU, specializing in technology and civil liberties. We're talking about police surveillance and, in particular, facial recognition technology. Tell me, Matt, about the tendency towards secrecy with the development of these kinds of technologies and use. I am aware that there's this product that police departments have been using for, I don't know, 10 years or longer, sometimes called a Stingray, that simulates a cell phone tower and is about the size of a briefcase. And if it's in a police vehicle and it's parked somewhere within a certain radius, it sort of grabs up all the cell phone data within a certain range. The Harris Corporation that makes these has police departments sign a non-disclosure agreement that says if someone asks if your police department has one of these, tell them no. So it can be hard to know what police departments have and don't have. I wonder what your experience is with trying to discover what kind of surveillance technologies police departments do have.
Well, all too often, community members are left in the dark about what sophisticated surveillance technologies their police and their governments are using. And this is for a few reasons. Like you said, one of them is that the manufacturers have sometimes imposed secrecy requirements on government agencies themselves. Part of it is because much of the surveillance technology infrastructure is funded by grants from the federal government through the Department of Homeland Security. And when those grants are available to pay for surveillance technology, that distorts the local democratic process because no longer does a law enforcement agency need to turn to a city council or board of supervisors and say, hey, we'd like to spend taxpayer money locally. They instead have free money coming in from another source, and so that also places sort of an incentive towards secrecy. And then sometimes law enforcement agencies want to avoid public scrutiny for their technologies, and so they keep the sort of acquisition quiet, and it doesn't rise to the level of public recognizing or noticing it. So we've done a lot of work at the ACLU to use public records requests, to use litigation, and to work on laws, too, that make sure that the public always has a seat at the table, because as I said before, once these systems are built, the harms are often much more difficult to undo, and the technology is then being used against community members in a way that may lead to harm. So one of the things that a lot of California communities are doing right now, especially in Northern California, is passing something called a surveillance ordinance that requires whenever police or city departments want to get surveillance technology, they have to go to the elected body, like the city council, tell the public what's going on and what they want, and seek permission in a democratic forum. And then if the community decides to move forward, and they may not, they need to have rules in place to make sure that civil rights and liberties are protected. So Oakland and San Francisco and Davis and Berkeley, the BART train system, have all passed these sorts of laws that bring these surveillance technologies out of the shadows. In San Francisco, what the government did there is they took that surveillance ordinance and said, let's pass this for all surveillance technologies to make sure the public has a say, but they specifically banned facial recognition during that process. So it kind of does two things. It says, you know, for most surveillance technologies, we're going to discuss it and have a public debate, but, you know, facial recognition is so dangerous, we're going to draw a line in the sand. And so we're really excited that California communities are really taking control of these issues.
Matt, I wanted to ask you about how it goes in particular trying to ban or slow down or look more closely at facial recognition technology and other new surveillance technologies right here in California, especially in Silicon Valley and San Francisco area where you are. That is the heart of the development of what has become sort of this sacred, monolithic realm of technological development. Everyone's quite excited about drones and being able to have sort of finally these science fiction TV phones, constant ability to connect with people. One thing, just to return to something we were touching on earlier that has to do with this, the large corporations that are making and developing surveillance equipment for police and military, like Microsoft, Amazon, and IBM, it's really eerie for me to recall that in 2001, I came across a book called IBM and the Holocaust, and I didn't realize until then that IBM had become quite a large international company by selling its technology, which at the time was sort of pre-computer, but it was a technology of data collection and categorizing. They sold that to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime. And now IBM is selling their latest data collection systems to police and military. Tell me about the struggle to pause. You mentioned that, and I think it's a really, really incredible idea to pause when someone comes up with a new technology, really of any sort. I would have hoped that people would have done that with automobiles and thought a little more intelligently about the long-term problems of automobiles and likewise with guns. But you mentioned this notion of pausing and discussing and really looking at surveillance technologies before they are put in place. What about doing all of that as you are within this culture of high tech?
Yeah, so on one hand, you know, for many decades now, and especially in the last decade, we've seen, you know, quick changes in the way that technology can impact our society and our daily lives. And the norm has been for technologies to be unleashed in society, and then for all of us and our policymakers to have to figure out how to clean up the mess, to address the harm, and to sort of rein in things that have grown and expanded into our lives. And, you know, we, working as a coalition at the ACLU, we really thought about that history when facial recognition really burst onto the scene and it became clear that more and more government agencies could purchase and deploy this very dangerous technology against their residents. So that history weighed heavily on our decision to champion bans in San Francisco and these other localities, as well as to lead the charge to make sure that it can't be used on body cameras here in California. All too often, these technologies are deployed, and then we, as a society, again, are left to clean up these issues. So I think that's a really great point. But, you know, we were actually happy to see that in places like San Francisco, at the heart of technological innovation, there was a recognition amongst the community and people who have tech backgrounds that this is a technology, facial recognition is a technology that is uniquely dangerous and that does present serious challenges to our democracy. And so there's a growing awareness, I think, in the tech industry. We're not completely there yet. But I think that San Francisco, at the heart of innovation in the United States and perhaps the world and the Bay Area, is making this decision to ban or prohibit governments from using this technology, sends a signal to other places that, hey, these folks who are sophisticated and understand this technology and frankly are helping to build it are sounding the alarm bell. And that is causing other places to listen. You know, Congress has held hearings and they talked about the San Francisco ban. And now the conversation federally has moved more towards pressing pause and really deliberating this technology. We're seeing conversations come out of Europe and the United Kingdom and newfound sort of activism around facial recognition there that is in part responding to what's happening here in California. So it's really difficult, I think, to overstate the impact that California communities can have when stepping up and defending civil rights and really being bold on these issues.
I would hope that there would be a ban on facial recognition technology for the Santa Cruz City Police Department, and folks will be gathering to talk about that and about the technology itself at a forum on October 25th that has been organized by the local ACLU. Lee Heppner will be there. He is an aide to San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin, who has created a ban on facial recognition. Matt Cagle, who is on the phone with me, Justin Cummings, who is Vice Mayor of Santa Cruz, and Tracy Rosenberg from Media Alliance. Here in Santa Cruz, over the past 10 years, there have been a couple of big battles about Santa Cruz Police Department access to new technologies and equipment. One of them was about license plate readers, and the other was about the police department getting a grant from the Department of Homeland Security to get an armored personnel carrier, and they never did get license plate readers for the police department. However, they did get a Bearcat armored personnel carrier, which is in use in Santa Cruz City. To me, it seems like it gets harder to struggle against the new technologies as you incorporate more and more of them, it becomes more normalized. If a city already has body cams on their police officers and license plate readers, then it maybe is harder to argue against just adding this other technology, facial recognition technology, for example. Can you just talk a little, Matt, about the difference between, or also your critique of these other technologies like license plate readers?
Yeah, so facial recognition is just one of the technologies that governments can use to track our whereabouts and our daily habits and private lives. We've done a lot of work at the ACLU to reveal and fight back against the unrestricted use of license plate readers as well, which is a technology that scans every car that passes the camera, tags it with a GPS tag, and that goes into a database. For years, communities across California have been using these technologies without meaningful limits. There have been people pulled over because the reader malfunctions, and those folks have been held at gunpoint because of misuse of these technologies. And just last year, we learned that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had gained access to a nationwide license plate reader database to assist their efforts to target and deport families and separate families. And so that is a prime example of why we need to think very carefully before we build new surveillance systems, because with license plate readers, we should learn the lesson there, which is that those systems grew and grew, and the databases grew and grew, and then others thought to exploit that data. And so now, right now, all of us are fighting to make sure that ICE can't simply enter a license plate into a system and get access to a local police department's license plate reader database to track down our neighbors and our families. And so that really, I think, underscores why it's important to have restrictions in place for license plate readers that are already out there. But moving forward, to think really hard about what it is we're building and what it is that a community is really going to have as consequences later on when we buy a surveillance system that is being pitched as a way to fight crime.
You know, you mentioned China early on in our conversation, and even when a technology is implemented in the best of circumstances in a sort of more close to democratic functioning society, that society can change and the leadership can change and then the use of the technology can change. You know, to return to something we started with, just this notion that some people have of, hey, what do I have to worry about if I don't commit any crimes? A couple of interesting things are that there was a book written called Three Felonies a Day, where this researcher discovered that on average, we all commit about three felonies a day. There's so many laws. So potentially, if you were connected with some political activism and police wanted to interrupt your activities, they could find excuses to do so. Also, just the psychological effect. I understand that there's research that just two people sitting in a room with a poster of someone looking at them, just an image of eyes observing them, makes their conversation less intimate and open and frank. So it's worrisome how this will all affect all of us. And I'm curious what you think about all of that. And there seems to be a shift happening, or maybe it's already happened, in what we think of as public and what we think of as private. I grew up, I'd say, basically with the idea that I can have a private conversation with someone or a group of people in a public place, in a park or at a restaurant or sitting on a corner. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this shift in what we think should be recorded or observed all the time in our lives.
Yeah, so I think on one hand, people you know, should have the ability and the control to decide that they want to record something and post it online. You know, we all use, many of us use social media, and we make decisions about what we post and what we don't post. Of course, many of the policies those companies have are not fully informing us or fully protecting our data once we do post things or use those services. But I think what's important for that point is that, you know, we should have the ability to share information and to use the internet and the amazing tools of modern society to communicate and connect and organize with people. That said, you know, there's certainly an argument coming from surveillance companies and from governments and from law enforcement agencies that, you know, folks who have nothing to hide have nothing to fear, and that you don't have privacy in the movements or the movements you make through public society, whether you're driving down the street or going about your daily life and attending a protest or a meeting. But that has really, that argument has really lost. It's a weak one, but it's really losing credibility as we realize that if the government knows where you've been, as you walked through public space and as you visited the doctor and gone to the liquor store, that can paint a detailed picture of your private life. And so the distinction between public and private is not always as so clear as proponents of surveillance would like us to think. Last year, the Supreme Court of the United States held that the government needs to get a warrant under the Fourth Amendment, which protects our privacy, when they seek your cell phone location records from Verizon or AT&T or Sprint. Those are records that are created when you're moving about your life in, technically, in public space as well as your private home. But the Supreme Court wasn't distracted by that. It recognized that the portrait of your private life includes things that may be public-facing, and the government has not traditionally been able to catalog and track those things, and that to strike the democratic balance, we need to make sure there are protections in place so that they can't freely do that.
Matt Cagle is an attorney with Northern California ACLU, and he will be here in Santa Cruz on October 25th. He'll be one of the panelists at the local Santa Cruz ACLU's Facial Recognition Technology Forum. Again, that's October 25th, 7 o'clock, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Matt, I'm really grateful for the work you're doing to discuss facial recognition technology and other surveillance. Anything you want to end with here that we didn't hit on?
No, I just look forward to seeing the community at the forum on the 25th, and we're really excited to hear from Santa Cruz residents and to be a resource if there's interest in making sure the community is the one that is in charge of decisions about surveillance.
Yes, it makes sense. That would almost look like a democratic culture.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping to move towards more and more here and to be a more perfect union. So thanks for having me.
Matt Cagle, thank you very much for making time to speak with me today. Thank you. Enjoy the day today.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. This is Transformation Highway. My name is John Malkin. This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California in Santa Cruz. Thank you to the local ACLU holding their forum on facial recognition technology on October 25th. Matt Cagle, thanks for speaking with me. Here now is a song about surveillance. And it's kind of an oldie, even. Boomtown Rats, Someone's Looking at You, from 1979.
answered twice. You come over to my place. You're screaming blue murder, needing some place to hide. Hey, well, I wish you'd be quiet. Imagination's run riot in these paper-thin walls. And when the place comes ablaze with a thousand drop names, I don't know who to call.
Well, shout it from the roof, scream it from your